letting it pivot around his index finger, so that the barrel pointed up and back.
Tanner,
one of the men said, rising, cheap metal flashing from his teeth.
Sutcliffe.
Trace of an accent, probably Australian.
Point team?
He looked at the other two.
Point,
Sutcliffe said, and probed his mouth with a tanned thumb and forefinger, coming away with a yellowed, steel-capped prosto. His own teeth were white and perfectly even.
You took Charvet from IBM for Mitsu, he said. And they say you took Semenov out of Tomsk.
Is that a question?
I was security for IBM Marrakesh when you blew the hotel.
Turner met the man's eyes. They were blue, calm, very bright.
Is that a problem for you?
No fear, Sutcliffe said. Just to say I've seen you work.
He snapped the prosto back in place.
Lynch,
nodding toward the other man,
and Wither,
toward the woman. Run it down to me, Turner said, and lowered himself into the scrap of shade. He squatted on his haunches, still holding the gun.
We came in 3 days ago, Weber said, on two bikes.
We arranged for one of them to snap its crankshaft in case we had to make an excuse for camping here.
There's a sparse transient population, gypsy bikers and cultists.
Lynch walked an optic spool 6 kilos east and tapped into a phone.
Private. Pay,
Lynch said.
We sent out a test squirt, the woman continued. If it hadn't worked, you'd know it.
Turner nodded.
Incoming traffic.
Nothing.
It's strictly for the big show, whatever that is.
She raised her eyebrows. It's a defection.
Bit obvious, that.
Sutcliffe said, settling himself beside Weber, his back to the wall.
Though the general tone of the operation so far suggests that we hirelings aren't likely to even know who we're extracting. True, Mr. Turner? Or will we be able to read about it in the fex?
Turner ignored him. Go on, Weber.
After our landline was in place, the rest of the crew filtered in, one or two at a time. The last one in primed us for the tank full of Japs.
That was raw,
Sutcliffe said.
Bit too far up front.
You think it might have blown us?
Turner asked.
Sutcliffe shrugged. Could be. Could be no. We hopped it pretty quick. Damned lucky we'd the roof to tuck it under.
What about the passengers?
They only come out at night, Weber said. And they know we'll kill them if they try to get more than 5 meters away from the thing.
Turner glanced at Sutcliffe.
Conroy's orders,
the man said.
Conroy's orders don't count now, Turner said.
But that one holds. What are these people like?
Medicals,
Lynch said.
Bent medicals.
You got it,
Turner said.
What about the rest of the crew?
We rig some shade with my medic tops. They sleep in shifts. There's not enough water, and we can't risk much in the way of cooking.
Sutcliffe reached for the coffee pot.
We have sentries in place, and we run periodic checks on the integrity of the landline.
He splashed black coffee into a plastic mug that looked as though it had been chewed by a dog.
So when do we do our dance, Mr. Turner?
I want to see your tank of pet medics. I want to see a command post.
You haven't said anything about a command post.
All set,
Lynch said.
Fine.
Here.
Turner passed Weber the revolver.
See if you can find me some sort of rig for this. Now I want Lynch to show me these medics.
He thought it would be you,
Lynch said, scrambling effortlessly up a low incline of rubble. Turner followed.
You've got quite a rep.
The younger man glanced back at him from beneath a fringe of dirty, sun-streaked hair.
Too much of one, Turner said. Any is too much. You worked with him before? Marrakesh?
Lynch ducked sideways through a gap in the cinder block, and Turner was close behind. The desert plants smelled of tar. They stung and grabbed if you brushed them. Through a vacant, rectangular opening intended for a window, Turner glimpsed pink mountaintops. Then Lynch was loping down a slope of gravel.
Sure, I worked for him before,
Lynch said, pausing at the base of the slide. An ancient-looking leather belt rode low on his hips. Its heavy buckle, a tarnished silver death's head with a dorsal crest of blunt pyramidal spikes.
Marrakesh, that was before my time.
Connie too, Lynch?
How's that?
Conroy.
You worked for him before?
More to the point, are you working for him now?
Turner came slowly, deliberately down the gravel as he spoke. It crunched and slid beneath his deck shoes, uneasy footing. He could see the delicate little Fletcher holstered beneath Lynch's denim vest. Lynch licked dry lips, held his ground.
That's such contact. I haven't met him.
Conroy has this problem, Lynch. Can't delegate responsibility. He likes to have his own man from the start, someone to watch the watchers.
Always. You the one, Lynch?
Lynch shook his head. The absolute minimum of movement required to convey the negative. Turner was close enough to smell his sweat above the tarry odor of the desert plants.
I've seen Conroy blow two extractions that way.
Turner said,
Lizards and broken glass, Lynch.
You feel like dying here?
Turner raised his fist in front of Lynch's face and slowly extended the index finger, pointing straight up.
We're in their footprint. If a plant of Conroy's bleeps the least fucking pulse out of here, they'll be onto us.
If they aren't already.
That's right.
Such your man.
Lynch said.
Not me. And I can't see it being Weber.
Black-rimmed, broken nails came up to scratch abstractedly at his beard.
Now, did you get me back here exclusively for this little talk? Or do you still want to see our can full of Japs?
Let's see it.
Lynch. Lynch was the one.
Once, in Mexico years before, Turner had chartered a portable vacation module, solar-powered and French-built. Its 7-meter body, like a wingless housefly sculpted in polished alloy, its eyes twin hemispheres of tinted, photosensitive plastic. He sat behind them as an aged twin-prop Russian cargo lifter lumbered down the coast with the module in its jaws, barely clearing the crowns of the tallest palms. Deposited on a remote beach of black sand, Turner spent 3 days of pampered solitude in the narrow, teak-lined cabin, microwaving food from the freezer and showering, frugally but regularly in cool, fresh water. The module's rectangular banks of cells would swivel, tracking the sun, and he'd learned to tell time by their position. Hosaka's portable neurosurgery resembled an eyeless version of that French module, perhaps 2 meters longer and painted a dull brown. Sections of perforated angle iron had been freshly brazed at intervals along the lower half of the hull and supported simple spring suspensions for 10 fat, heavily nubbed red rubber bicycle tires.
They're asleep, Lynch said. It bobs around when they move, so you can tell. We'll have the wheels off when the time comes. But for now, we like being able to keep track of them.
Turner walked slowly around the brown pod, noting the glossy black sewage tube that ran to a small rectangular tank nearby.
Had to dump that last night, Jesus.
Lynch shook his head.
They got food and some water.
Turner put his ear to the hull.
It's proofed,
Lynch said. Turner glanced up at the steel roof above them. The surgery was screened from above by a good 10 meters of rusting roof, sheet steel, and hot enough now to fry an egg. He nodded. That hot rectangle would be a permanent factor in the Moss infrared scan.
Bats, Weber said, handing him the Smith & Wesson in a black nylon shoulder rig.
The dusk was full of sounds that seemed to come from inner space. Metallic squeaks and the cackling of bugs, cries of unseen birds. Turner shoved a gun and holster into a pocket on the parka.
You wanna piss, go up by that mesquite.
But watch out for the thorns.
Where are you from?
New Mexico, the woman said, her face like carved wood in the remaining light. She turned and walked away, heading for the angle of walls that sheltered the tarps. He could make out Sutcliffe and a young black man there. They were eating from dull foil envelopes. Ramirez, the on-site console jockey, Jaylene Slide's partner, out of Los Angeles.
Turner looked up at the bowl of sky. Limitless. The map of stars.
Strange how it's bigger this way, he thought. And from orbit it's just a gulf. Formless. And scale lost all meaning. And tonight he wouldn't sleep, he knew. And the Big Dipper would whirl round for him and dive for the horizon, pulling its tail with it. A wave of nausea and dislocation hit him as images from the Biosoft dossier swam unbidden through his mind.
Chapter 8 Paris.
Andrea lived in the Quartier de Tourne, where her ancient building, like the others in her street, awaited sandblasting by the city's relentless renovators. Beyond the dark entrance, one of Fuji Electric's biofluorescent strips glowed dimly, above a dilapidated wall of small wooden hutches, some with their slotted door still intact. Marley knew that postmen had once made daily deposits of mail through those slots. There was something romantic about the idea, although the hutches, with their yellowing business cards announcing the occupations of long-vanished tenants, had always depressed her. The walls of the hallway were stapled with bulging loops of cable and fiber optics, each strand a potential nightmare for some hapless utilities repairman. At the far end, through an open door paneled with dusty pebble glass, was a disused courtyard, its cobbles shiny with damp. The concierge was sitting in the courtyard as Marley entered the building on a white plastic crate that had once held bottles of Avion water. He was patiently oiling each link of an old bicycle's black chain. He glanced up as she began to climb the first flight of stairs, but registered no particular interest. The stairs were made of marble, worn dull and concave by generations of tenants. Andrea's apartment was on the fourth floor. Two rooms, kitchen and bath. Marley had come here when she closed her gallery for the last time, when it was no longer possible to sleep in the makeshift bedroom she'd shared with Alan, the little room behind the storeroom. Now the building brought her depression circling in again. But the feel of her new outfit and the tidy click of her boot heels on marble kept it at a distance. She wore an oversized leather coat a few shades lighter than her handbag, a wool skirt, and a silk blouse from Paris Isetan. She'd had her hair cut that morning on Faubourg Saint-Honoré by a Burmese girl with a West German laser pencil. An expensive cut, subtle, without being too conservative. She touched the round plate bolted in the center of Andrea's door,
heard it peep once, softly, as it read the whorls and ridges of her fingertips.
"It's me, Andrea,"
she said to the tiny microphone. A series of clanks and tickings as her friend unbolted the door. Andrea stood there, dripping wet in the old terry robe. She took in Marley's new look, then smiled.
"Did you get your job, or have you robbed a bank?"
Marley stepped in, kissing her friend's wet cheek.
"It feels a bit of both,"
she said and laughed.
"Coffee," said Andrea. "Make us coffee, grand creme. I must rinse my hair, and yours is beautiful."
She went into the bathroom, and Marley heard a spray of water across porcelain.
"I brought you a present,"
Marley said, but Andrea couldn't hear her. She went into the kitchen and filled the kettle, lit the stove with the old-fashioned spark gun, and began to search the crowded shelves for coffee.
"Yes," Andrea was saying. "I do see it."
She was peering into the hologram of the box Marley had first seen in Virek's construct of Gaudi's Park. "It's your sort of thing." She touched a stud and the Brown's illusion winked out. Beyond the room's single window, the sky was stippled with a few wisps of cirrus.
"Too grim for me.
Too serious. Like the things you showed at your gallery?
But that can only mean that Herr Virek has chosen well. You will solve his mystery for him. If I were you,
considering the wage,
I might take my own good time about it."
Andrea wore Marley's gift, an expensive, beautifully detailed man's dress shirt in gray Flemish flannel. It was the sort of thing she liked most, and her delight in it was obvious. It set off her pale hair and was very nearly the color of her eyes.
"He's quite horrible, Virek, I think."
Marley hesitated.
"Quite likely,"
Andrea said, taking another sip of coffee.
"Do you expect anyone that wealthy to be a nice, normal sort? I felt at one point that he wasn't quite human.
Felt that very strongly."
"But he isn't, Marley. You were talking with a projection, a special effect. Still..."
She made a gesture of helplessness, which immediately made her feel annoyed with herself.
"Still, he is very, very wealthy, and he's paying you a great deal to do something that you may be uniquely suited to do."
Andrea smiled and readjusted a finely turned charcoal cuff.
"You don't have a great deal of choice, do you?" "I know. I suppose that's what's making me uneasy." "Well," Andrea said, "I thought I might put off telling you a bit longer, but I have something else that may make you feel uneasy, if uneasy is the word." "Yes. I considered not telling you at all, but I'm sure he'll get to you eventually. He smells money, I suppose."
Marley put her empty cup down carefully on the cluttered little rattan table.
"He's quite acute that way,"
Andrea said.
"When?" "Yesterday. It began, I think, about an hour after you would have had your interview with Virek. He called me at work.
He left a message here with the concierge. If I were to remove the screen program..." She gestured toward the phone. "I think he'd ring within 30 minutes. Remembering the concierge's eyes, the ticking of the bicycle chain.
"He wants to talk, he said,"
Andrea said. "Only to talk.
Do you want to talk with him, Marley?" "No,"
she said. And her voice was a little girl's voice, high and ridiculous. Then,
"Did he leave a number?"
Andrea sighed, slowly shook her head, and then said,
"Yes, of course he did."
Chapter 9. Up the Projects. The dark was full of honeycomb patterns the color of blood. Everything was warm and soft, too, mostly soft. "What a mess," one of the angels said, her voice far off but low and rich and very clear. "We should have clipped him out of Leon's," the other angel said. "They aren't going to like this upstairs."
"Must have had something in this big pocket here, see? They slashed it for him, getting it out."
"Not all they slashed, sister. Jesus. Here."
The pattern swung and swam as something moved his head, cool palm against his cheek.
"Don't get any on your shirt,"
the first angel said.
"Two-a-day ain't gonna like this." "Why you figure he freaked like that and ran?"
It pissed him off because he wanted to sleep. He was asleep for sure, but somehow Marcia's jack dreams were bleeding into his head so that he tumbled through broken sequences of people of importance. The soap had been running continuously since before he was born. The plot, a multi-headed narrative tapeworm that coiled back in to devour itself every few months, then sprouted new heads hungry for tension and thrust. He could see it writhing in its totality, the way Marcia could never see it, an elongated spiral of sense-net DNA, cheap, brittle ectoplasm spun out to uncounted hungry dreamers. Marcia now, she had it from the POV of Michelle Morgan Magnum, the female lead, hereditary corporate head of Magnum AG. But today's episode kept veering weirdly away from Michelle's frantically complex romantic entanglements, which Bobby had anyway never bothered to keep track of, and jerking itself into detailed socio-architectural descriptions of Soleri-style mincom arcologies. Some of the detail even to Bobby seemed suspect. He doubted, for instance, that there really were entire levels devoted to the sale of ice-blue shaved velour lounge suites with diamond-buckled knees, or that there were other levels, perpetually dark, inhabited exclusively by starving babies. This last, he seemed to recall, had been an article of faith to Marcia, who regarded the projects with superstitious horror, as though they were some looming vertical hell to which she might one day be forced to ascend. Other segments of the Jack Dream reminded him of the Knowledge Channel SenseNet piped in free with every STEM subscription. There were elaborate, animated diagrams of the project's interior structure, and droning lectures and voiceover on the lifestyles of various types of residents. These, when he was able to focus on them, seemed even less convincing than the flashes of ice-blue velour and feral babies creeping silently through the dark. He watched a cheerful young mother slice pizza with a huge industrial water knife in the kitchen corner of a spotless one-room. An entire wall opened onto a shallow balcony and a rectangle of cartoon blue sky. The woman was black without being black, it seemed to Bobby, like a very, very dark and youthfully maternal version of one of the porno dolls on the unit in his bedroom, and had, it looked like, the identical small but cartoon-perfect breasts. At this point, to add to his dull confusion, an astonishingly loud and very unnet voice said, "Now I call that a definite sign of life, Jackie. If the prognosis ain't looking up yet, at least something is." And then went spinning back into the all-glitz universe of Michelle Morgan Magnum, who was desperately struggling to prevent Magnum AG's takeover by the sinister Shikoku-based Nakamura Industrial Clan, represented in this case by, plot complication, Michelle's main squeeze for the season. Wealthy, but somehow grindingly in need of additional billions, new Soviet boy politician Vasily Suslov, who looked and dressed remarkably like the Gothics in Leon's. The episode seemed to be reaching some sort of climax. An antique BMW fuel cell conversion had just been strafed by servo-piloted miniature West German helicopters on the street below Covina Concourse Courts. Michelle Morgan Magnum was pistol-whipping her treacherous personal secretary with a nickel-plated Nambu, and Suslov, who Bobby was coming increasingly to identify with, was casually preparing to get his ass out of town with a gorgeous female bodyguard who was Japanese but reminded Bobby intensely of another one of the dream girls on his holoporn unit. When someone screamed. Bobby had never heard anyone scream that way, and there was something horribly familiar about the voice. But before he could start to worry about it, those blood-red honeycombs came swirling in again and made him miss the end of People of Importance. Still, some part of him thought, as red went to black, he could always ask Marcia how it came out. Open your eyes, man. That's it. Light too bright for you? It was, but it didn't change. White. White. He remembered his head exploding years away. Pure white grenade in that cool wind desert dark. His eyes were open, but he couldn't see. Just white. Now, I'd leave you down ordinarily, boy in your condition. But the people paying me for this say, get a jump on. So I'm waking you up before I'm done. You're wondering why you can't see shit, right? Just light, that's all you can see, that's right. What we got here is a neural cutout. Now, between you and me, this thing come out of a sex shop, but there's no reason not to use it in medicine if we want to. And we do want to because you're still hurting bad, and anyway, it keeps you still while I get on with it. The voice was calm and methodical. Now, your big problem, that was your back, but I took care of that with a stapler and a few feet of claw. You don't get any plastic work here, you understand? But the honeys will think those scars are real interesting. What I'm doing now is I'm cleaning this one on your chest, then I'll zip a little claw down that, and we're all done, except you better move easy for a couple of days or you'll pull a staple. I got a couple of derms on you, and I'll stick on a few more. Meantime, I'm going to click your sensorium up to audio and full visual so you can get into being here. Don't mind the blood. It's all yours. But there isn't any more coming. White curdled to gray cloud, objects taking form with the slow deliberation of a dust vision. He was flat against a padded ceiling, staring straight down at a blood-stained white doll that had no head at all, only a greenish-blue surgical lamp that seemed to sprout from its shoulders. A black man in a stained green smock was spraying something yellow into a shallow gash that ran diagonally from just above the doll's pelvic bone to just below its left nipple. He knew the man was black because his head was bare. Bare and shaven. Slick with sweat. His hands were covered in tight green gloves, and all that Bobby could see of him was the gleaming crown of his head. There were pink and blue dermadiscs stuck to the skin on either side of the doll's neck. The edges of the wound seemed to have been painted with something that looked like chocolate syrup, and the yellow spray made a hissing sound as it escaped from its little silver tube. Then Bobby got the picture, and the universe reversed itself sickeningly. The lamp was suspended from the ceiling was mirrored, and he was the doll. He seemed to snap back on a long elastic cord, back through the red honeycombs, to the dream room where the black girl sliced pizza for her children. The water knife made no sound at all. Microscopic grit suspended in a needle stream of high-speed water. The thing was intended to cut glass and alloy, Bobby knew, not to slice microwaved pizza. And he wanted to scream at her because he was terrified she'd take off her thumb without even feeling it. But he couldn't scream, couldn't move or make a sound at all. She lovingly sliced the last piece, towed the kick plate that shut the knife down, transferred the sliced pizza to a plain white ceramic platter, then turned toward the rectangle of blue beyond the balcony where her children were. No, Bobby said, weighed down in himself. No way. Because the things that wheeled and plunged for her weren't hang-gliding kids, but babies. The monstrous babies of Marcia's dream. And the tattered wings, a confusion of pink bone, metal, patched, taut membranes of scrap plastic. He saw their teeth. Whoa, said the black man. Lost you for a second. Not for long, you understand, just maybe a New York minute. His hand, in the mirrors overhead, took a flat spool of blue transparent plastic from the bloody cloth beside Bobby's ribs. Delicately, with thumb and forefinger, he drew out a length of some sort of brown, beaded plastic. Minute points of light flashed along its edges and seemed to quiver and shift. Claw, he said, and with his other hand thumbed some sort of integral cutter in the sealed blue spool. Now the length of beaded stuff swung free and began to writhe. Good shit, he said, bringing the thing into Bobby's line of sight. New. What they use in Chiba now. It was brown, headless, each bead a body segment. Each segment edged with pale, shining legs. Then, with a conjurer's flick of his green-gloved wrists, he lay the centipede down the length of the open wound and pinched delicately at the final segment, the one nearest Bobby's face. As the segment came away, it withdrew a glittering black thread that had served the thing as a nervous system. And as that went, each set of claws locked shut in turn, zipping the slash tight as a new leather jacket. Now, you see, said the black man, mopping the last of the brown syrup away with a wet white pad. That wasn't so bad, was it? His entrance to Two-A-Day's apartment wasn't anything like the way he'd so often imagined it. To begin with, he'd never imagined being wheeled in a wheelchair that someone had appropriated from St. Mary's maternity. The name and a serial number neatly laser-etched on the dull chrome of the left armrest. The woman who was wheeling him would have fitted neatly enough into one of his fantasies. Her name was Jackie. One of the two project girls he'd seen at Leon's, and, he'd come to understand, one of his two angels. The wheelchair was silent as it glided across the scabrous gray wall-to-wall of the apartment's narrow entranceway, but the gold bangles on Jackie's fedora tinkled cheerfully as she pushed him along. And he'd never imagined that Two-A-Day's place would be quite this large or that it would be full of trees. Pi, the doctor who'd been careful to explain that he wasn't a doctor, just someone who helped out sometimes, had settled back on a torn bar stool in his makeshift surgery, peeled off his bloody green gloves, lit a menthol cigarette, and solemnly advised Bobby to take it real easy for the next week or so. Minutes later, Jackie and Rhea, the other angel, had wrestled him into a pair of wrinkled black pajamas that looked like something out of a very cheap ninja kino, deposited him in the wheelchair, and set out for the central stem of elevators at the Arcology's core. Thanks to an additional 3 dirhams from Pai's store of drugs, one of them charged with a good 2,000 mics of endorphin analog, Bobby was alert and feeling no pain.
"Where's my stuff?"
he protested, as they rolled him out into a corridor grown perilously narrow with decades of retrofitted ducts and plumbing.
"Where's my clothes and my deck and everything?"
"Your clothes, hon, such as they were, are taped up in a plastic bag waiting for Pi to shit-can him. Pi had to cut him off you on the slab, and they weren't but bloody rags to begin with. If your deck was in your jacket down the back, I'd say the boys who chopped you out got it. Damn near got you in the process. And you ruined my Sally Stanley shirt, you little shithead."
Angel Rhea didn't seem too friendly.
"Oh," Bobby said as they rounded a corner. "Right. Well, did you happen to find a screwdriver in there or a credit chip?"
"No chip, baby. But if the screwdriver's the one with the 210 new ones screwed into the handle, that's the price of my new shirt."
Two-a-Day didn't look as though he was particularly glad to see Bobby. In fact, it almost seemed as if he didn't see him at all. Looked straight through him to Jackie and Rhea, and showed his teeth in a smile that was all nerves and sleep-lack. They wheeled Bobby close enough that he saw how yellow Two-a-Day's eyeballs looked, almost orange in the pinky-purple glow of the grow-light tubes that seemed to dangle at random from the ceiling.
"What took you, bitches?"
the wearman asked, but there was no anger in his voice, only bone weariness and something else, something Bobby couldn't identify at first.
"Pie,"
Jackie said, swaggering past the wheelchair to take a package of Chinese cigarettes from the enormous wooden slab that served Two-a-Day as a coffee table.
"He's a perfectionist, old Pi. Learned that in vet school,"
Rhea added for Bobby's benefit.
"Except usually he's too wasted. Nobody let him work on a dog."
"So,"
Two-a-Day said, and finally let his eyes rest on Bobby.
"You're gonna make it."
And his eyes were so cold, so tired and clinical, so far removed from the hustling manic bullshitter's act that Bobby had taken for the man's personality, that Bobby could only lower his own eyes, face burning, and lock his gaze on the table. Nearly 3 meters long and slightly over a meter wide, it was strapped together from timbers thicker than Bobby's thigh. It must have been in the water once, he thought. Sections still retained the bleached, silvery patina of driftwood, like the log he remembered playing beside a long time ago in Atlantic City. But it hadn't seen water for a long time, and the top was a dense mosaic of candle drippings, wine stains, oddly shaped overspray marks in matte black enamel, and the dark burns left by hundreds of cigarettes. It was so crowded with food, garbage, and gadgets that it looked as though some street vendor had set up to unload hardware, then decided to have dinner. There were half-eaten pizzas, krill balls and red sauce, and Bobby's stomach began to churn, beside cascading stacks of software, smudged glasses with cigarettes crushed out in purple wine dregs, a pink styrene tray with neat rows of stale-looking canapes, open and unopened cans of beer, an antique Gerber combat dagger that lay unsheathed on a flat block of polished marble, at least 3 pistols, and perhaps 2 dozen pieces of cryptic-looking console gear, the kind of cowboy equipment that ordinarily would have made Bobby's mouth water. Now his mouth was watering for a slice of cold krill pizza. But his hunger was nothing in the face of his abrupt humiliation at seeing that Two-a-Day just didn't care. Not that Bobby had thought of him as a friend exactly, but he definitely had something invested in the idea that Two-a-Day saw him as someone, somebody with talent and initiative and a chance of getting out of Barrytown. But Two-a-Day's eyes told him he was nobody in particular,
and a Wilson at that.
Look here, my man. Someone said, not Two-A-Day, and Bobby looked up.
Two other men flanked Two-A-Day on the fat chrome and leather couch, both of them black. The one who'd spoken wore a gray robe of some kind and antique plastic-framed glasses. The frames were square and oversized and seemed to lack lenses. The other man's shoulders were twice as wide as Two-A-Day's, but he wore the kind of plain black two-piece suit he saw in Japanese businessmen in kinos. His spotless white French cuffs were closed with bright rectangles of gold microcircuitry.
"It's a shame we can't let you have some downtime to heal up," the first man said. "But we have a bad problem here."
He paused, removed his glasses, and massaged the bridge of his nose.
"We require your help."
"Shit,"
Two-A-Day said. He leaned forward, took a Chinese cigarette from the pack on the table, lit it with a dull pewter skull the size of a large lemon, then reached for a glass of wine. The man with the glasses extended a lean brown forefinger and touched Two-A-Day's wrist. Two-A-Day released the glass and sat back, his face carefully blank. The man smiled at Bobby.
"Count zero," he said. "They tell us that's your handle."
"That's right,"
Bobby managed, though it came out as a kind of croak.
"We need to know about the virgin count."
The man waited. Bobby blinked at him.
"Vierge Mirac."
And the glasses went back on.
"Our Lady, Virgin of Miracles. We know her."
And he made a sign with his left hand.
"As Ezilifreda."
Bobby became aware of the fact that his mouth was open, so he closed it. The three dark faces waited. Jackie and Rhea were gone, but he hadn't seen them leave. A kind of panic took him then, and he glanced frantically around at the strange forest of stunted trees that surrounded them. The grow light tube slanted at every angle, in any direction. Pink-purple jackstraws suspended in a green space of leaves. No walls. You couldn't see a wall at all. The couch and the battered tables sat in a sort of clearing, with a floor of raw concrete.
"We know she came to you,"
the big man said, crossing his legs carefully. He adjusted a perfect trouser crease, and a gold cufflink winked at Bobby.
"We know. You understand?"
"Two-A-Day tells me it was your first run,"
the other man said.
"That the truth?"
Bobby nodded.
"Then you are chosen of Legba,"
the man said again, removing the empty frames.
"To have met Vierge Mirac."
He smiled. Bobby's mouth was open again.
"Legba," the man said. "Master of roads and pathways. The lower of communication."
Two-A-Day ground his cigarette out on the scarred wood, and Bobby saw that his hand was shaking. Chapter 10. Alan. They agreed to meet in the Brasserie on the fifth sublevel of the Napoleon Court complex, beneath the Louvre's glass pyramid. It was a place they both knew, although it had had no particular meaning for them. Alan had suggested it, and she suspected him of having chosen it carefully. It was neutral emotional ground, a familiar setting, yet one that was free of memories. It was decorated in a style that dated from the turn of the century. Granite counters, black floor-to-ceiling beams, wall-to-wall mirror, and the sort of Italian restaurant furniture in dark welded steel that might have belonged to any decade of the past 100 years. The tables were covered in gray linen with a fine black stripe,
a pattern picked up and repeated on the menu covers and matchbooks on the aprons of the waiters. She wore the leather coat she'd bought in Brussels, a red linen blouse, and new black cotton jeans. Andrea had pretended not to notice the extreme care with which she dressed for the meeting, and then had loaned her a simple single strand of pearls, which set off the red blouse perfectly. He'd come early, she saw as she entered, and already the table was littered with his things. He wore his favorite scarf, the one they'd found together at the flea market the year before, and looked, as he usually did, disheveled but perfectly at ease. The tattered leather attaché case had disgorged its contents across the little square of polished granite. Spiral notebooks, an unread copy of the month's controversial novel, Gauloise non-filters, a box of wooden matches, the leather-bound agenda she'd bought for him at Brown's.
"I thought you might not come,"
he said, smiling up at her.
"Why would you have thought that?"
she asked. A random response, pathetic, she thought, masking the terror she now felt, that she allowed herself at last to feel, which was fear of some loss of self, of will and direction, fear of the love she still felt. She took the other chair and seated herself as the young waiter arrived, a Spanish boy in a striped apron, to take her order. She asked for Vichy water.
"Nothing else?"
Alan asked. The waiter hovered.
"No, thank you." "I've been trying to reach you for weeks," he said, and she knew that that was a lie, and yet, as she often had before, she wondered if he was entirely conscious of the fact that he was lying.
Andrea maintained that men like Alan lied so constantly, so passionately, that some basic distinction had been lost. They were artists in their own right, Andrea said, intent on restructuring reality. And the New Jerusalem was a fine place indeed, free of overdrafts and disgruntled landlords and the need to find someone to cover the evening's bill.
"I didn't notice you trying to reach me when Nas came with the police,"
she said, hoping at least that he would wince. But the boyish face was calm as ever. Beneath clean brown hair, he habitually combed back with his fingers.
"I'm sorry," he said, crushing out his Gauloise.
Because she'd come to associate the smell of the dark French tobacco with him, Paris had seemed full of his scent, his ghost, his trail.
"I was certain he'd never detect the nature of the piece. You must understand, once I had admitted to myself how badly we needed the money, I knew that I must act. You, I knew, were far too idealistic. The gallery would have folded in any case, if things had gone as planned with Nas. We would be there now, and you would be happy."
"Happy," he repeated, taking another cigarette from the pack. She could only stare at him, feeling a kind of wonder and a sick revulsion at her desire to believe him.
"You know," he said, taking a match from the red and yellow box, "I've had difficulties with the police before, when I was a student. Politics, of course."
He struck the match, tossed the box down, and lit the cigarette.
"Politics,"
she said, and suddenly felt like laughing.
"I was unaware that there was a party for people like you. I can't imagine what it might be called."
"Molly," he said, lowering his voice, as he always did when he wished to indicate intensity of feeling. "You know, you must know that I acted for you. For us, if you will. But surely you know, you can feel, Molly, that I would never deliberately hurt you or place you in jeopardy."
There was no room on the crowded little table for her purse, so she'd held it in her lap. Now she was aware of her nails, buried deep in the soft, thick leather. "Never hurt me."
The voice was her own,
lost and amazed. The voice of a child, and suddenly, she was free. Free of need, desire, free of fear, and all that she felt for the handsome face across the table was simple revulsion. And she could only stare at him, this stranger she'd slept beside for 1 year, in a tiny room behind a very small gallery in the Rue Mauconseil. The waiter put a glass of Vichy down in front of her. He must have taken her silence for the beginning of acceptance, the utter blankness of her expression, for openness.
"What you don't understand,"
this, she remembered, was a favorite opening,
"is that men like Nas exist in some sense to support the arts, to support us, Marley."
He smiled then, as though he laughed at himself, a jaunty, conspiratorial smile that chilled her now.
"I suppose, though, that I should have credited the man with having at least the requisite sense to hire his own Cornell expert, although my Cornell expert, I assure you, was by far the more erudite of the two."
How was she to get away? Stand, she told herself. Turn. Walk calmly back to the entrance. Step through the door. Out into the subdued glitter of Napoleon Court, where polished marble overlay the Rue du Champfleury, a 14th century street said to have been reserved primarily for prostitution. Anything, anything, only go, only leave now. And be away, away from him, walking blind to lose herself in the guidebook Paris she'd learned when she'd first come here.
"But now," he was saying, "you can see that things have worked out for the best. It's often like that, isn't it?"
Again the smile, but this time it was boyish, slightly wistful, and somehow, horribly, more intimate.
"We've lost the gallery, but you've found employment, Marley. You have a job to do, an interesting one, and I have the connections you'll need, Marley. I know the people you'll need to meet in order to find your artist."
"My artist?" Covering her abrupt confusion with a sip of Vichy, he opened his scarred attaché and removed something flat. A simple reflection hologram. She took it, grateful to have something to do with her hands, and saw that it was a casual shot of the box she'd seen in Virek's construct of Barcelona. Someone was holding it forward. A man's hands, not Alan's, and on one of them, a signet ring of some dark metal. The background was lost. Only the box and the hands.
"Alan," she said, "where did you get this?"
Looking up to meet brown eyes filled with a terrible, childlike triumph.
"It's going to cost someone a very great deal to find out."
He ground out a cigarette and stood. "Excuse me." He walked away, headed in the direction of the restrooms. As he vanished behind mirrors and black steel beams, she dropped the hologram, reached across the table, and flipped back the lid of his attaché. There was nothing there. Only a blue elastic band and some crumbs of tobacco.
"May I bring you something else? More Vichy, perhaps?"
The waiter stood beside her. She looked up at him, struck suddenly by a sense of familiarity, the lean, dark face.
"He's wearing a broadcast unit," the waiter said. "He's armed as well. I was the bellman in Brussels. Give him what he wants. Remember that the money means nothing to you."
He took her glass and placed it carefully on his tray.
"And very likely it will destroy him."
When Alan returned, he was smiling.
"Now, darling,"
he said, reaching for his cigarettes,
"we can do business.
Marley smiled back and nodded. Chapter 11. On Site. He allowed himself 3 hours of sleep finally, in the windowless bunker where the point team had established the command post. He'd met the rest of the site team. Ramirez was slight, nervous, perpetually wired on his own skill as a console jockey. They were depending on him, along with Jaylene Slide on the offshore rig, to monitor cyberspace around the grid sector that held the heavily iced banks of Moss Biolabs. If Moss became aware of them, at the last moment, he might be able to provide some warning. He was also charged with relaying the medical data from the surgery to the offshore rig, a complex procedure if they were to keep it from Moss. The line out ran to a phone booth in the middle of nowhere. Once past that booth, he and Jaylene were on their own in the Matrix. If they blew it, Moss could backtrack and pinpoint the site. And then there was Nathan, the repairman, whose real job consisted of watching over the gear in the bunker. If some part of their system went down, there was at least a chance he could fix it. Nathan belonged to the species that had produced Oki and 1,000 others Turner had worked with over the years, maverick techs who liked earning danger money and had proven they could keep their mouths shut. The others, Compton, Teddy, Costa, and Davis, were just expensive muscle. Mercs. The sort of men you hired for a job like this. For their benefit, he'd taken particular care in questioning Sutcliffe about the arrangements for clear-out. He'd explained where the copters would come in, the order of pickup, and precisely how and when they would be paid. Then he'd told them to leave him alone in the bunker, and ordered Weber to wake him in 3 hours. The place had been either a pump house or some sort of nexus for electrical wiring. The stumps of plastic tubing that protruded from the walls might have been conduit or sewage line. The room provided no evidence that any of them had ever been connected to anything. The ceiling, a single slab of poured concrete, was too low to allow him to stand, and there was a dry, dusty smell that wasn't entirely unpleasant. The team had swept the place before they brought in the tables and the equipment. But there were still a few yellow flakes of newsprint on the floor that crumbled when he touched them. He made out letters, sometimes an entire word. Each of the folding metal camp tables had been set up along a wall, forming an L, each arm supporting an array of extraordinarily sophisticated communications gear, the best he thought that Hosaka had been able to obtain. He hunched his way carefully along the length of each table, tapping each console, each black box, lightly as he went. There was a heavily modified military sideband transceiver, rigged for squirt transmission. This would be their link, in case Ramirez and Jaylene flubbed the data transfer. The squirts were pre-recorded elaborate technical fictions, encoded by Hosaka's cryptographers. The content of a given squirt was meaningless, but the sequence in which they were broadcast would convey simple messages. Sequence BCA would inform Hosaka of Mitchell's arrival, FD would indicate his departure from the site, while FG would signal his death and the concurrent closure of the operation. Turner tapped the sideband rig again, frowning. He wasn't pleased with Sutcliffe's arrangements there. If the extraction was blown, it wasn't likely they'd get out, let alone get out clean. And Weber had quietly informed him that, in the event of trouble, she'd been ordered to use a handheld anti-tank rocket on the medicals in their miniature surgery.
"They know," she said. "You can bet they're getting paid for it, too."
The rest of them were depending on the helicopters, which were based near Tucson. Turner assumed that Moss, if alerted, would easily take them out as they came in. When he'd objected to Sutcliffe, the Australian had only shrugged.
"It isn't the way I'd set it up under the best circumstances, mate. But we're all in here on short notice, aren't we?"
Beside the transceiver was an elaborate Sony biomonitor, linked directly with the surgical pod and charged with the medical history recorded in Mitchell's Biosoft dossier.